We Will Not Be Tamed, a Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation podcast that encourages all Texans to get involved in conserving the wild things and wild places of our state.
I'm Lydia Saldana with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, and today we're going to be talking about quail with two experts, John McLaughlin, who's the West Texas Quail Program Leader with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and Kelly Thompson, who's the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation Chairman Emeritus and also Chairman of TPWD's Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, why don't we just start, let's start at the 30,000 foot level, and let's just start with just an overview on the status of quail in Texas. And I think, John, you're probably the best person to address that question to. What's your elevator speech when you're asked that question?
Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks for the question, and thanks for having me and Kelly here today. Really, thanks to the foundation. I've listened to a lot of these podcasts. Most recently, the one on public land dove hunting with the good folks over at Fawcett. I know the foundation had a big hand in establishing that. So, the podcasts are great. Great organization. Great partner. And again, excited to be here with Kelly, who's certainly a friend to quail and a friend of the department. So. Well, obviously nothing better than talking about quail on a Friday afternoon as the fall is just around the corner. But in terms of quail in Texas, I think I'd remind everyone that we actually have four species of quail. We have the Gambel's quail and Montezuma quail found in West Texas and Edward Plateau. And then really the more iconic northern bobwhite scale quail, which I think more people are familiar with on an everyday basis. And so when we talk about the status of quail, we've certainly observed steady declines across their range, certainly nationally over the past 100 years, but we've seen an acceleration of that decline in recent decades and most recently here in Texas. And so importantly, we don't see quail decline in a vacuum, and we've seen about a 30% reduction in grassland bird species abundance since the 1970s. And so we know that there's really something universally out there impacting populations at a broad scale, and it's larger than any individual factor or stressor. And so we approach it from that perspective. And I think fundamentally, most conservationists agree that, you know, reductions in the quantity and quality of native habitat are driving a lot of that decline. And again, those stressors vary from the East Coast, where changing timber practices, to out here out west, where we have changing land use and encroachment of things like mesquite brush and others. And so while Texas does remain a stronghold, we haven't been immune from some of those declines. But what I would say is that, you know, we certainly recognize that the decline is happening. We've developed a pretty extensive network of partners and private landowners dedicated to reversing those declines. And I think, you know, importantly, what we've seen is that long-term, large-scale investments in habitat management work, you know, can have an impact on the landscape. I think, you know, notably, we've seen that through America's wetlands and through a combination of research, conservation policy and programs, diverse partnerships and investments from private landowners. They've seen about a 40% increase in wetland populations over the last 50 years. So we like to say that grasslands are the new wetlands. There's a lot of focus, energy, money, enthusiasm going into saving quail and Texas quail. And the reversal won't happen overnight, but we're making strong strides, setting ourselves on the right course for decades to come. And we're eternal optimists. So we believe in the collective will.
That's awesome. And I'm going to dive into this a little bit more, a little further into the discussion. But I want to ask Kelly, Kelly, of course, your interest in quail is well known by anybody who knows you. What is it about quail and quail hunting that intrigues you so much?
Well, thank you, Lydia. And like John, I'm very happy to be on this podcast. This is a first for me. But I've got to take issue with your introduction as you referenced expert. And I'm for sure am no expert and would observe, as many hunters would, that there is enough debate about quail that McLaughlin definitely qualifies as an expert, but there's very few that truly are an expert in quail. But for quail, as well as just any of the upland game bird species, I find most interesting and enjoyable given the challenge of the complexity of all the moving parts. It is unlike migratory birds, deer, I mean, dove or duck or goose, or to generally shot, you know, in a solitary mode, in a blind, or deer hunting, or antelope hunting. It's generally, you know, you're by yourself with a gun waiting for the prey. Quail involve bird dogs, retrieving dogs, generally a number of hunters at once in a hunting group. Now, most often involving hunting vehicles, sometimes additional dog handlers. And the game changes with every step along the way. As you travel through different habitat, you're going from prairie to grass to brush throughout the day. It is the most involved and intriguing game bird sport or hunt of them all, which is what attracts me to it. Now, it doesn't have to be complex. I mean, I can remember, you know, and often see, you know, that single dog box strapped to the back of a pickup truck or in a Suburban, and it can be as simple and as solitary as if someone enjoying the hunt with the companionship of the dog. And for me, though, it is and true all about the dogs, for better, for worse, and often in my case for worse, as many of my folks know, but that's what drives me to enjoy quail so much.
Callie, have you been quail hunting all your life? I mean, did you grow up doing it?
Gosh, great question. No. You know, we started hunting quail, I guess, all my life, you know, in high school, you know, along when we, but that was just such a different environment. We had no dogs. We had pump shotguns, and we would troop along fence lines and draws, you know, going from, just like a bird dog would go, go from objective to objective that we thought might have a quail. And it is pretty crude, but I'd say when I was 22, my best pal bought a bird dog, and then there was two of us and a dog, and it just has evolved from there.
So, John, are you a quail hunter? I mean, I know you're surrounded by quail in your professional job. What is your connection to quail beyond your professional responsibilities?
Yeah, well, I would echo a lot of what Kelly said. It's, you know, quail hunting is unique challenge and experience that I think we all get to enjoy. As he said, it's not stationary, and the dogs are a big part of that. You know, certainly for me personally, you know, I started upland game bird hunting, you know, grouse out west far before I really started getting into quail. But, you know, once I found them, I think like a lot of folks, I became addicted very quickly. I like to say that when you come up on a dog and then you bust a covey, it's sort of like a grenade going off, and then simultaneously these little rockets going off in the horizon. And so it's very exciting, you know, and as Kelly said, you know, oftentimes you can be with a group of people in the back of a truck, you know, multiple bird dogs running around, or sometimes, you know, you have a single bird, a single dog box. For me, it's a camper shell on my truck that I load my dog up in, and we go camp on the edge of a national grassland or camp out at a WMA. So I am a quail hunter, love to do it. You know, beyond work, you know, beyond hunting, certainly I just have a love for birds in general. I like to say that, you know, I had a choice between an ornithology class, which is, you know, a study, scientific study of birds, ornithology and animal behavior in my undergrad. And I actually skipped the ornithology class thinking that I didn't want to work with birds. And I had big ambitions of wolves and cougars out west. But I had some mentors in my early 20s who really put me on a path to learning more about birds. And, you know, I certainly have an obsession, like many of us do there. And the eruptive cycle here we see in Texas, you know, every year is a new year, and exciting. And certainly the dog work is, I think, the, you know, one of the biggest pleasures we get. And really, when you miss a bird, you actually feel worse for your dog, you know, than sometimes you do for yourself. So it is a unique experience. I love to hunt, love to quail hunt. And I don't have a high class bird dog, but my mutt dog does pretty darn well. So
something tells me I could do a whole nother podcast just about bird dogs, but that's another topic for another day. Hey, John, I don't know your background. What brought you to Parks and Wildlife? Give us a little backstory on how you got to Parks and Wildlife.
Oh yeah, of course. So I was born and raised in New England, and went to the University of New Hampshire to get my undergrad. I studied wildlife ecology out there, and during that time, I took a few jobs out west. I started off by working in the Dakotas, and then ended up in Nevada. And it was really when I moved up to Washington and Oregon that I started working with upland game birds, and specifically the greater sage grouse, which is obviously much like the quail, an iconic, you know, American species. And so I had got a lot of experience, and part of what attracted me to that work was not just the bird itself, but the interaction with farmers and ranchers and small town communities. You know, when I was growing up, you know, the timber industry and the fishing industries in New England were on the decline. And I moved out west and found this vibrant agricultural communities, vibrant, you know, small town, rural town America. And so the two of those combined really got me excited. And after a brief hiatus in Minnesota, I saw a job or an opportunity to come down and go to grad school at Texas Tech, working with quail. And it said work on the Four Sixes Ranch in Central Texas. And I thought, that sounds right up my alley. And so I did end up going to grad school at Texas Tech, and that was my introduction to Texas quail. And even though I left for a little while back to the Pacific Northwest, when I saw this job that I'm in now come open just over 3 years ago, I just couldn't resist the temptation, applied for it, and was very fortunate to be offered. And it's been a great couple of years, and very, very excited to be back in this state, you know, helping the cause.
Well, we're glad you're here. And Kelly, I'm going to ask you a similar question about your backstory in conservation, because, of course, you've been involved with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation. I mentioned at the top of the podcast your service on the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee, but I know you're involved with other conservation organizations as well. Can you just give us a little bit backstory about how you've gotten involved and why you've gotten involved?
You know, the many people who just have a passion for being outdoors, you know, hunting is just a manifestation of that passion. It's just another release to not be in a rural office setting. And I think that's just what's so attractive about being involved with Texas Parks and Wildlife, because that's the brand that gets us there. I do want to say something about John. I was blessed to be part of the process that brought John to the department. And it was because we have a fabulous quail leader in Robert Perez, who those of us who've tried to support quail through the department for years scratched our head. We've got 254 counties, and we were counting on Robert to cover all 254 counties. And Robert lives, you know, just southeast of San Antonio. Fortunately, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation recognized this itch that the department had. The department just constantly have, funding and appropriation challenges and can't scratch all of the itches. And so we were blessed that the foundation offered to sponsor by grant starting John's position. And we are blessed that John was just a fabulous candidate, and we're blessed that he accepted the offer. So just a little plug for John and the foundation in that. Maybe I am involved with a few other organizations. Probably one I enjoy the most is called the Borderlands Research Institute, which is a part of Sol Ross University in the Borderlands region of the Trans-Pecos in Alpine, Texas. And it's just a wonderful research outfit. It's run by a well-known hero of mine, Lewis Harbison. And
he's my hero too, Kelly. He's my hero too. He's a hero to a lot of people.
he really is. He founded that organization. And my plug for them, it's really interesting. So, you know, there's six great, we're blessed to have six fabulous research outfits dedicated to quail and other species in Texas. Caesar Clayburgh in Kingsville, Rolling Plains Quail Research Ranch in Roby, Quail Tech Alliance in Lubbock, Texas Tech Wildlife Taxology Laboratory in Lubbock, Borderlands in Alpine and Tarleton State in Stephenville. But what I like to say, to talk about Borderlands, is every one of those organizations have great grad students passionate about you know, the species they're involved with. But you look at the kids or the young people that are at Borderlands, you've got to want to be in Alpine, Texas. It is on the far edge of the earth and one of those pretty places, but it's full time for them. There's no distraction other than working on their species, and they've done a great job. Ryan Luna, Dr. Ryan Luna, runs their quail function. He's just completed a big research project. He's got an army of young students that they will be publishing, I think, before year end, with a focus on parasite loads, and both in the eye and in the gastro regions. And there's a lot of people focusing on that, but what they're trying to accomplish is to determine if there's a correlation with changes in habitat relative to the parasite load. And we're all very excited for that publication to be produced. But that's where I do spend some time helping to support Lewis and Borderlands research.
That's awesome. Now, I know, John, you're probably working with all of those universities. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the work that's happening right now, you know, in terms of trying to reverse this decline, and just in general, what can landowners and others who are interested in quail conservation do to help?
Yeah, no, of course, Lydia. Well, you know, I think Kelly hit upon some of the really big, you know, research university institutions across the state, and they're sort of fuel for the engine. You know, it's a large partnership. It takes many people from many different sectors to make this happen, whether it's, you know, partners in the oil and gas or private landowners or these great organizations and universities. And so, you know, on a research front, you know, we've tried to make strides to support research that would identify why some of these declines are happening. Most notably, a few years ago, we used about $500,000 in state and federal money, matched with private dollars out of Texas Tech University and Quail Tech Alliance, who Kelly mentioned, and you know, to investigate, you know, what's happening with scaled quail in West Texas, and why are we seeing declines, and why are populations on this downward trend? And so, you know, we have some ideas about, you know, the factors that are driving that change, you know, changes in land use, and as I mentioned before, some mesquite and juniper encroachment out in that part of the state. But, you know, as we progress recently, we're going to put out another request for proposals this fall to look at scale quail declines in South Texas, a subspecies down there that we refer to as the chestnut-bellied scale quail. So research is a really important part of identifying what the needs are, and then we take that research and apply it on the ground. In terms of landowners, obviously, you know, it's easy for a lot of us, I think, to drive around a landscape and look at someone's farm or ranch and say, hey, these are the things that need to be done for quail. But, you know, actually translating that plan into action on a property can be a tall order for a lot of folks. And so what I think any landowner is, you know, the only step you need to take to get involved is just to reach out. And, you know, we have an incredible amount of people across the state. As Kelly mentioned, we have 254 counties, and we have a district biologist that covers every county in the state. So if you go on Google and type in TPWD, find a biologist, you'll find what our folks with expertise and local knowledge. And really from there, they can bring together, you know, multiple partners. So, you know, for example, if you wanted to conserve quail, you know, they could come out there and say, hey, you know, these are the steps you need to take, or, you know, other partner organizations like Quail Forever, Wildlife Habitat Federation, and maybe a grazing plan is part of that. So we might reach out to the Texas Grazing Lands Coalition and Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, their folks on the ground who have expertise. And then maybe that landowner needs some infrastructure development to drive that plan, and so he could go to a natural resources conservation service office and get cost share to do some of those practices. So many partners involved. All they have to do is reach out, and we can help them develop that plan. I always say that quail management is about having the will, time, money, and patience. And so, you know, as long as they have the initial will to come have a conversation with us, you know, we can help them, you know, get where they want to be, whether it's next year or 5 or 10 years from now. So.
And timely rainfall helps too, right?
Yeah, no doubt. We need rainfall. That's a key component. So,
So, Kelly, I'd like to just ask you for your observations, because you've been observing quail conservation efforts in Texas for a lot of years now. What's your perception of just progress over time of getting our arms around this issue and trying to do something positive?
Well, there's a lot of people focused on the decline of quail abundance, as the biologists like to call population, and it's dramatic. In 1992, we had 225,000 quail hunters. Last year, we had 30,000 quail hunters.
Oh, wow.
And that that is consistent with the decline in the population.
Yeah.
And as John said, as you talk about rain, it really is all about rain, because rain influences the habitat. You know, the decline of quail is a product of significant habitat fragmentation, for sure. But the grazing practices that have evolved, particularly in West Texas, the difference in West Texas and South Texas, well, it's interesting. The department has been conducting a roadside quail count throughout the state, over 165 same transits since 1978. So it's an incredible database. And over that time, the Rolling Plains or West Texas actually has a higher average annual observation rate than South Texas. And I think we all believe that, or believe in that South Texas has higher quail population today than West Texas. And I think that's significantly influenced by, there's many landowners down there that have acquired ranches and really dedicated its purpose to recreational hunting. And so their focus is on the habitat. They've got lower stocking rates. They stock truly to manage for quail. West Texas does not, is not blessed with those. Although there are large ranches, there's only a few that have, that can afford to manage the ranch for recreation. They're really managing to make groceries. And as a result, West Texas is more challenged today relative to South Texas. So what does that mean? There's a, there's all the stakeholders who are passionate about quail, and man, there are a lot of stakeholders, and there's not one that's, for lack of an opinion, have all raised the hand wanting to give time, give money to these research outfits to help try to figure out how do we restore quail populations. I'd say at the top of the heap, we're blessed to have an organization called Park City, the Quail Coalition, which is headquartered, or the main chapter is the Park City's Quail. They really came in and stepped in the shoes of what was Quail Unlimited, that was managed on the East Coast and just was not as effective as it might be. And so all of the chapters in Texas left, and the Quail Coalition was created by Joe Crafton in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Has done an incredible job raising money for quail research and habitat work. They've got 11 chapters throughout the state, I think 3,500 members. Last year, each chapter raises, does fundraising. Dallas always is by far at the top. In one dinner, they raised $1.9 million last year dedicated to quail research, which is just incredible. And so that's what's evolving. A lot of people supporting these research organizations through banquets, through donations, to try to figure out how to stem the tide. I think the other things at risk is with the decline of quail and the decline of then quail hunters. It's, as we know, throughout all game species, it's the hunters that fund conservation research for declining population in any species. And as our hunting community has declined to 30,000 people last year, for example, and I think that number might be a year old, it may be less than that, so goes the conservation dollars. So we've got to do a better job at gaining visibility to recruit people back into the business of being worried about quail, which should segue to your next question, which I hope.
I just think what you were saying, it just underscores, when people are passionate about something and hunters are passionate about what they do, they put their money where their mouths are. They want to support it. And, we see that. We're seeing that throughout. And the Park City's quail, what you talked about is a prime example of that. But that is a good segue, because I think a lot of people listening to this are probably curious and getting ready for the next the season, the upcoming season. And, John, what is the forecast for the upcoming season? Let's get into that.
Yeah, well, no, it's a great lead. And I would echo Kelly's comments there. If you've ever been to that Quail Coalition, any of their dinners, whether it be in Wichita Falls or Dallas, it's an amazing event, amazing collection of people. When you leave Texas and you go to some of those Western states and they hear about dinners like that and they see the pictures and the people and the excitement, the enthusiasm, and the level of, people, quality of people, the character that are there, it's one of the most impressive things that happens in our community annually. And so very exciting. I'm glad Kelly mentioned that. In terms of our upcoming quail season, as I said before, being eternal optimist, I feel like that's a lot of quail hunters. We'll see what's going on, whether it be drought or too sunny, and we'll still go kick our dogs out. But I think, unfortunately, this year, we're probably going to be in a little bit of a lull cycle again, like we've been in the past couple of years. Our statewide surveys that Kelly alluded to, these roadside counts, they're meant to capture quail abundance at the ecoregion level. So these broad multi-county levels. And so, our forecast, certainly there may be ranches or farms that buck the trend or buck our forecast and have good seasons. But generally across the state, we're looking at probably slightly below average season this year. Out in the rolling plains, we came out of winter. I think a lot of people were feeling good. We saw pairing, so males and females pairing up early on, but we just didn't see that translate into nests. And importantly, we didn't see that translate into broods on the ground. And unfortunately, we got into a cycle of 100-degree days and drought-like conditions. I don't want to say it was full-blown drought, but drought-like conditions. So, given the low breeding stock out of last year and that, lack of early season nesting and then the curtailing of that nesting season in the rolling plains, we certainly got hit a little bit. Places like the Matador WMA or Wildlife Management in Cottle County, they did get some late season rain and have been hearing some more activity again. So maybe that's, again, the optimist in me. But as for the other big region, for bobwhite, South Texas, again, our roadside count showed that, pretty low abundance down there. But we've heard a lot of anecdotal stories, especially from the coastal sand plains. So think Clayburg, Kennedy, Brooks County. And I think they did get some midsummer rain. Also got buoyed with a little bit of hurricane rainfall. Thankfully, it was just a shower. It didn't hit like some of the hurricanes of past years. And so I think in very far South Texas, I think there's actually a lot of excitement for hunting. And, if you know somebody down there, if you can get a lease down there, that's probably a great place to travel this year for bobwhites. And the other region we often talk about is out in the Trans-Pecos, so far west Texas, Big Bend region, with our scaled quail. And scaled quail, did go down slightly this year in our abundance counts. But, per usual, they're a pretty hardy bird. Physiologically, they can withstand drought a bit better than bobwhite. And so we didn't see the big dip like we saw in the rolling plains. And so we expect if you head out that way and go to Black Gap or Elephant Mountain, that you will have some opportunities to hunt. So all I can say is I'm going to be out there with a dog and a truck and a gun, and no matter the forecast, I'm going to give it a go. So
something tells me that Kelly will be out there too, right, Kelly?
I will. I hope to be. Yes, I will.
Kelly, I want to circle back around. I've mentioned the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee a couple of times in this conversation, and might be good just to explain for our listeners, what is that committee and what does that committee do and what are the priorities for the committee? I know y'all just recently met.
Sure. The Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee is one of, I think, 11 active committees at the department. There is a Whitetail Deer Committee. There is a Coastal Conservation Committee, so on and so forth. The Upland covers the upland species quail, pheasant, chakalaka, and others. And it's comprised of lay people like myself, who's not a biologist, and biologists, all appointed by the chairman of the TPW Commission. Every 4 years, I believe, the committee's role is to provide advice on programs and policies to the department and or the commission. It's really advisory, as it's named. We meet twice a year. John and I participated on a virtual committee meeting on Wednesday that lasted 5 hours and 40 minutes.
But who's counting?
Because we cover a lot of stuff, a lot of species, and there's a lot of stakeholders, it is very active. But our role is not to dictate policy, but make recommendations on policy for consideration by the commission and or the department leadership.
Is there anything of note that, you know, that y'all talked about or are working on that our listeners might want to hear about?
Well, we cover a lot of ground, John. I'll let you take first stab at it since you ran most of it.
I think as Kelly said, you know, the committee is diverse and we have a lot of people on there, industry professionals, farmers and ranchers, whomever it may be who has an interest in upland game bird management. And he correctly stated that it's more than just quail. It's turkeys and pheasant and chachalaca. And so, I think, most recently, we've had a lot of East Texas wild turkey restoration work going on. So that was certainly a topic of discussion and organizations like the National Wild Turkey Federation going through some changes. But on a quail front, we talked about our small game harvest survey, which we conduct every year to get an index of where our hunters and harvest are going. And so, as Kelly stated, we've seen those downward trends. So that harvest survey helps us identify where there might be a need. We also did review the annual quail hunting forecast, which was exciting. Translocation, so moving quail from one part of the state to the other or interstate, has been a topic of national discussion lately. And certainly there's a lot of translocation work going on in Texas, trying to refine that technique, see if it can be successful. Myself and some others from Texas Parks and Wildlife were offered the opportunity through the Rolling Plains Quail Research Ranch to travel to Georgia and Florida a few weeks ago to visit with Tall Timbers Research Station. And they've conducted a lot of translocation research over there. And so we compared notes, both from a research perspective and a state agency perspective and how they accomplished some of those things. And it took a lot of partnership work. So, we talked to the committee about, how those efforts have been going, how we've been trying to assist and where we can go in the future to see if that might not be a tool. I think as was said in the meeting, perhaps a carrot to management. So, if you do management for 5 or 10 years, perhaps, we can translocate bird onto a property and kickstart a population. So I think that was certainly a topic of discussion. The quail license plate, which I know we're going to talk about, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, that was a topic of discussion. I think everyone's excited to see where that goes. And so, as Kelly said, very diverse conversation, a lot of feedback, and it's essential. As a state agency, you don't want to be insular. You want to be accountable and credible. And I think groups like the advisory committee help us, maintain that credibility and hold us account to, how we're spending funds, how we're, allocating positions and how we're approaching, quail management and upland game bird management more broadly.
Well, thanks for that. And you gave me the perfect opening to talk about the quail license plate, because I do want to talk about that. It's just amazing, over the course of the conversation, how many different partners, that we've talked about. There's so many partners and players. Of course, hunter dollars are paying for a lot of this research, but there's always a need for more. And that's the big reason for the launch of the quail conservation license plate. And Kelly, I'm going to turn this back to you because I know you were involved in that. Can you give us the backstory on how this plate came to be?
Yeah, glad to. Well, I've really got to give credit back to the biggest vocal champion for the last 10 years is Dr. Dale Rollins of the Rolling Plains Quail Research Ranch. And for a long time, AgriLife staffer, biologist. Dale recognized years ago that those deer hunters had a very successful deer hunting plate where the department received a part of the revenue from the sale of the deer hunter plates and scratched his head, why can't we have a quail plate? And the department was challenged a little bit in terms of kind of getting that over the goal line. So lo and behold, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation volunteered to sponsor the plate with the assistance of the department to get it over the goal line. It's interesting, the quail plate is cost an incremental $30 more to the regular plate, $22 of which gets captured by the foundation, dedicated for use by the department on quail research, habitat, other programs. I think we started in 2017. It's interesting that we've tried to generate a little competition by and amongst the different counties where plates are sold. For a minute there, Tarrant County actually was at the top of the heap. It's now been surpassed. I think Harris County is the top, followed by Dallas. I think Tarrant and Travis are tied. But it's a wonderful way of getting visibility for quail conservation by sticking it on the back of your truck. We've got people that have them on motorcycles, have them on four-wheelers, and have them on scooters, and have them on trailers. So it's not just limited to your truck or car. But that's kind of the backstory on that. Our goal is, we'd like to be competitive with those crazy deer hunters. They have, I think the numbers are, let me see if I can find that. I had that up. I think the deer hunters through when we launched it had achieved over 9 years, close to $800,000 in income to the department that's dedicated for deer projects. They've got deer hunters have 750,000 hunters annually. We started this project. We had 80, as I mentioned, it's down to 30 this last year. So if we can achieve the same participation rate relative to our quail hunters as to the penetration of deer plates to the number of deer hunters, you know, we're hoping to generate $10,000 a year annually that can go towards quail. And we would encourage anybody listening to this podcast, if they'd consider at their next license plate renewal, to check the box to convert that to a Texas quail conservation plate.
And it is a handsome plate. It really is. And for those of you out there who are interested in buying it, just go to conservationplate.org and you can click on the quail plate, and it's just as easy as that. So I hope folks will do that. John, any comments about the quail plate that you want to make?
I would just echo Kelly's comments. I mean, you know, we love having them out there. Now that there is a segment of people buying those, we hope that more folks see those. And yeah, that money will go directly towards Texas quail conservation. And, you know, between the department and the foundation in determining, you know, where to put those dollars, how to spend those dollars. But Lydia, I would agree. It's a very good looking plate, you know, really something you can be proud of to have on your truck or motorcycle or ATV, whatever it may be. We would certainly encourage you to go onto the website and get and renew with that plate. Really, really great cause.
Awesome. Well, that's I think a good note to kind of wrap things up on. Do either of you have any closing comments you'd like to make?
You know, from a conservation point of view, this quail plate is about conservation. The only other option I'd make that I was trying to think about earlier is, you know, we used to try to count the number of birds we kill when we or harvest when we're on a quail hunt, I think it's really interesting that how the whole trend is conservation centric. We no longer count how many birds we harvest. We count how many coveys we find. And that's all about trying to understand how we've influenced and what is influencing quail conservation today. And that's kind of a consistent kind of metric of how most quail stakeholders now look at quail hunting.
I would have to agree, Kelly. It's about the experience. It's about being out there. It's about the dog work. I think hunting itself is a chance to immerse yourself in nature. And the more time you spend out there, the more you get in tune with the changes of the seasons, the changing in the landscape. You really start to find your groove. I think to the average passerby, the landscape is relatively homogenous, in the fall and things are brown. But I think for any of us that spend time either hunting or birding or outdoor recreating, it's the nuance is incredible. And so I think quail conservation fits into that mold. And as a closing comment for me, Lydia, I would say certainly thanks to the foundation. And Kelly mentioned earlier that the foundation was a big sponsor in terms of donation to get the West Texas Quail Program Leader position started up, an incredible feat. For anyone that works in government, adding, full-time employees isn't easy, but it's through the dedication of your organization, Kelly and others, that my job got put into place. And 3 years later, here we are, talking on a podcast, and it's been really wonderful. So we at Parks and Wildlife Department appreciate everything the foundation does and certainly appreciate the opportunity to come on podcasts and again, talk about quail and their conservation here in Texas.
Well, thank you both for taking the time this afternoon to be with us. It's been a great conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lydia. Everybody go back.
Thank you, Lydia.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Brought to you by Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, We Will Not Be Tamed calls us all to appreciate the wildness of Texas, the vastness of our Texas spirit, and why we should be inspired to conserve it. Find out more at wewillnotbetamed.org.